Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, Upstart Crow listeners, and welcome to another episode. I'm your host, William Miller. My guest today is novelist David Baldacci. David is a global number one best-selling novelist who began scribbling stories as a child in a notebook his mother gave him to keep him engaged and quiet in order to give herself a bit of a break. Now his total number of works is quickly approaching 60 titles, which have sold more than 150 million copies in more than 45 languages in more than 80 countries. His books have been turned into feature films as well as television adaptations. He and his wife have co-founded the Wish You Well Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to supporting literacy efforts across America, reading being an activity that he believes builds empathy and enriches the lives of those who practice it. He lives in his native Virginia, where he graduated from Virginia Commonwealth University and the University of Virginia Law School, two noteworthy public institutions. He was a practicing lawyer with a DC firm before beginning his career as a writer. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Today, we're focusing primarily, at least, on one of your more recent novels, A Calamity of Souls. But to be clear, as we record this, Calamity of Souls is not your most recent book. It has, in fact, been out circulating for more than a year. But it seems to warrant a serious discussion at this point. In other words, now seems a ripe time to have this kind of discussion. You often express appreciation for teachers, which is a sentiment that I totally agree with. But I also want to say a word here at the beginning for booksellers, especially small shop independent booksellers. It was one such person who connected this book for me to James Baldwin. I looked up the connection, and you referred to reading Baldwin's The Fire Next Time when you were writing this novel, and you praised Baldwin. So what influences did the essay in Baldwin's book have on you and on the novel?
Well, you know, I had read James Baldwin when I was in high school and also in college. And I think that Baldwin is probably the most elegant writer that this country's ever produced. I mean, you can't read a Baldwin sentence and not know that it's James Baldwin. And, you know, he had two strikes against him when he was alive. He was African-American and he was also gay. So for him, inclusivity amongst a number of communities was not possible. The Fire Next Time is two components to it. One is a letter that he wrote to his nephew when he turned 16, which for a lot of African-American males in particular, is, you know, crossing the Rubicon in many ways, because you're probably going to have encounters with law enforcement that are not going to turn out well for you. And secondly, it was an essay really on racism in America. I've read most of Baldwin's works. If you want a collection of short stories that'll knock your socks off, get The Price of a Ticket, that I think he wrote in the 1970s, that is a brilliant mantra and record and just coda on life in America that applies just as much today as it did when he wrote the novel, when he wrote the short stories. I also, when I was writing Calamity of Souls, I wanted to engage more than just with words. So I went and listened and watched the debate that he took place in Cambridge, I think in the early 60s, when he debated William F. Buckley on the issue of white superiority and black inferiority. And without notes, Baldwin delivered one of the most scintillating, you know, speeches that I've ever seen in my life. And anybody, I would challenge anyone to watch that and not come away affected deeply by what he said. As a white person growing up in Virginia in the 60s and 70s, I witnessed and observed many, many examples of bigotry and discrimination and some violence and just prejudice at a level that would stun anyone, I would hope. But I was never the target of that because my skin color afforded me protection. So, you know, being a witness to bigotry and being the target of it is, to borrow a phrase from Mark Twain, is quite a large difference between the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. But growing up in Richmond as I did, as a white person with a very ethnic last name, so I was not afforded some inclusivity as well, because I was deemed sort of, you know, the guy with the funny last name. You know, I was an observer of a lot of things, and I was sort of looked at myself as, you know, being on the other side of the glass looking in a lot. And when I was writing A Calamity of Souls, I drew upon Baldwin, I drew upon my own observations, my own thoughts, people I grew up with, who many thought that, you know, a divided world was perfectly fine. And I could have probably, you know, I might have turned out that way too. But I've always thought that, you know, as Mark Twain also said, travel is fatal to prejudice. He traveled the world many times. I could never travel outside of Richmond when I was a kid, but I went to the library and I traveled the world without a plane ticket or a passport. And I got to meet many people in many places I'm never going to venture to. But I've always thought that books were body armor against bigotry, because once you experience people in books, you will understand their plight, their challenges. You will understand they are just like you. And so, you know, these prejudicial things that they're different from you that I would hear growing up, they're different from you. They're dangerous. Stay away from them. They're not like us. Books gave me, you know, the perfect body armor against that. I never believed any of that, because I had met these people in books. I knew they were people just like me. And I drew upon that when I was writing Calamity. For the longest time, I started Calamity 14 years ago. I didn't think I was going to finish it. I wrote the first 150 pages by hand. I wrote A Calamity of Souls on day one. I had no idea where the title came from. It just seemed to stick with me. I put the novel aside for years. I'd go back to it. Put it aside, go back to it. About 8 or 9 years ago, I thought, well, you know what? If I didn't tell you it was 1968 in the opening chapters, you probably would just assume it was a contemporary novel. And I thought, okay, then it's worth finishing. So I went back and I finished it. And I thought it was relevant again. And I hope it would resonate with people.
So Baldwin's essay was originally published in 1960. Well, the first bits of it were in The New Yorker in 1962. The book itself came out in 1963. As you just said, the novel is set in 1968. But you began writing it, I think you have said, on Christmas Day of 2011. Yeah. And put it aside for a while and then picked it back up again about 2020, I believe.
Yes.
I'm kind of interested in, I mean, what was going on in 63, what was going on in 2011, and what was going on in 2020. I'm primarily interested in what was going on in your life in 2011 that stimulated you on Christmas Day, when your wife gave you that unlined notebook to go in, which is so reminiscent of the notebooks your mother gave you, but to go into your writing space and begin A Calamity of Souls. So talk a little bit about that, if you would, for a moment.
I think 2011 was significant because we're roughly halfway through Obama's first term. And, you know, when he was first elected, it was a beautiful thing. I thought, you know, maybe finally this country has collectively turned a corner. And then the hatred and vitriol, animosity, fighting him tooth and nail in everything he was trying to do. And seeing racism rear its ugly head again in the streets as bold protest, because we had the, you know, audacity to elect an African American to the presidency, I decided that maybe I needed at least to flesh out my own thoughts and observations. I started writing it in the journal by hand. I had no real clear thought that this was going to end up actually being a novel that I was going to publish, but when I'm concerned about things and things worry and frustrate me, the first thing I do is grab some paper and a pen, and I start writing it down so I can try to make sense of things.
That is incidentally the first reaction of a writer.
It is the first reaction of a writer. Words are my home. Words are my safe space. You know, I can't tell. I wrote 5 novels during COVID because I just wanted to get away from what was going on during, you know, the hellish times of COVID. And then as I continued to write, I thought about, well, you know, writers, first time writers usually write about things that have happened to them because those influences are so strong. I never did that. My first 45 books were just my imagination, things I was interested in. And then Calamity, though, represented me, you know, and how I grew up and the thoughts that I had and, you know, growing up in the 60s and 70s in the old capital of the Confederacy. You know, I was born into a totally segregated world. I'm an older guy, but it's not like I'm 100 years old. My world was black and white, in all literal respects, and the twain never shall meet. And then I started thinking about, well, instead of just fleshing out thoughts, maybe this is finally that first novel you should have written way back when, drawing upon your own past, which can be daunting. All my other books are just, there wasn't me in them so much. I wasn't going out on a personal limb about this is how my experience in the world. And those two confluences about, just being frustrated with the reaction to Obama's first term, and then the fact that I had never written my first novel that talked about, my world, came together. And then all of a sudden I started thinking about maybe this is going to be, a novel that I'm going to turn out.
But you didn't set it in 2011.
No. I was a political science major in college. I'm steeped in reading history from all sorts of countries, but mostly my own. 1968, even though I was only 8 years old, I remember my brother was 7 years older than me, so he was 15, and he would become of draft age while the Vietnam War was still going on, and that was a whole nother hellish experience for our family. But I could see my parents, the worry and concern of my parents. Because 68 was a volatile year, and people rightly so think we're going through some traumatic times right now. But 1968, you had the Vietnam War tore the soul of this country completely apart. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in June. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in April. You had the Democratic Convention in Chicago in that fall that turned into a riot and chaos. And a lot of people thought that, okay, this is the end of America. I mean, how are we going to survive all of this? So I set it in 1968 to show that one of the most hellish years of the quarter millennia this country's been in existence. 1968 would rank right up there as probably one of the worst. And so I wanted to set it there because I wanted what had happened during that year to sort of influence the novel as well. So people know that, okay, we're in 68 when two giants in the civil rights movement, Kennedy and King, were assassinated. And the Vietnam War was tearing this country apart. And in the middle of all that, we had this murder trial.
And of course, you evoke that in the opening pages of the novel. It's a very moving beginning because you evoke I guess it's not giving away too much. We're talking about a double murder, and we're talking about a couple, and we're starting with them and their. You don't depict it specifically, but you evoke it in a very rich way, and then you kind of dolly back the camera, if you will, and there are these two deputies beating up this guy that they have found on site, and you make reference in one of the sentences to them being Bible readers, the couple being Bible readers, and the stories that they found there, including stories of violence, and then it goes to that violence.
Oh, probably more wars have started in the name of religion than any other, incentive that we've had in world history. And that book can obviously be one that generates great peace and kindness, and then the exact opposite of those. And again, that opening scene was really brutal, and my first readers on it thought, I mean, it's quite a punch in the face to open the novel with, but I didn't want people to drift into this story. I wanted to grab them by the throat and pull them into it. And I just wanted them to understand that what I was trying to write in the story I thought was really important and relevant to their lives today, even though it was set 50 years ago. And that I thought was the best way to do it.
Have you had any reactions one way or the other?
I've had both. I mean, I would say that, 95% of the reactions have been overwhelmingly positive. But I think people realize in their gut that what the book talks about still haunts us to this day. I mean, nobody can look at the news and dispute the fact that racism still permeates throughout every culture in this country, every strata of this country. We have, Supreme Court is little by little just tearing down the walls of trying to make the playing field level. And it's still very much a white-dominated world in this country. Strides have been made. There have been a lot of successes, but there's also been a lot of slipping back.
And a lot of backlash.
Yes.
One of the things that you did very well, and incidentally, I think you used the word confluence, you had to get to a certain point in development as a writer to have the confluence of personal experience and writerly craft to be able to put this book together. And a friend of mine, Richard Bausch, former colleague at George Mason, used to talk about, you know, every work finds its time. And I guess this book did for you, and you started it, but it wasn't quite there. It didn't gel. So then you put it aside and you came back to it. But you have in the novel your typical array of characters who have certain possibilities. And here we're talking about the ability to change being pivotal. You have Jack's mom, who grew up very self-reliant and very strong, but also closely aligned with a young black fellow, and she lost that possibility. We have Jack himself, who I know you have somewhat mirrored yourself in him, your lead character. And Jack at first doesn't want to take on Jerome's murder trial because he's not sure he's up for it. And I think you objectively have said he wouldn't be up for it. But he comes under the influence of a young black woman lawyer, civil rights crusading kind of character who is strong and capable, Desiree. And she comes in and really, you know, she does great. But neither one of them could win this case on her or his own, because it's an all-white, all-male jury. She wouldn't win in that case unless she could pull some things together, as kind of happens in the course of the trial. But on a normal case, neither one of them could win. But you also have characters who don't change, who resist change at all levels in any way. Did you do that consciously in terms of arraying those characters?
I did. I tell people that to understand why people are racist, you have to understand how they came to be racist. It's not a one size fits all. People come there different ways. And I grew up with people who got to that path and to that ending, you know, through various journeys. Hillary's example was that she was not racist at all growing up. She loved, you know, someone who was not of the same color as she was. That opportunity was taken away from her. And because of that, she sort of fell into following the herd mentality. That's how she became a racist. The two cops in the novel came at it a different way. Not only did they were raised to be racist, they seemed to revel in the fact that they were, believed themselves to be superior. There was no redeeming value. And people say, well, they're not very complicated characters. No, they're not, but they're real characters. I've met a lot of them in my life. And I wanted people to understand it, because the only way you can unravel racism is in someone is to understand how they came to be that way. If you don't know their journey, there's no way for you to have an opportunity to try to get them onto a better path. And the other thing I was dealing with, you know, everybody was going to compare this novel to To Kill a Mockingbird, which is a seminal, legendary, iconic novel. And early on, when I was sitting down to write the book, my daughter, who just recently graduated from law school, she'd been out for a while and went back to get a law degree because she thought she could represent people, and particularly marginalized communities, in a better way with a law degree, and I agreed. She said, Dad, please don't make this a white savior book. She goes, I really liked Mockingbird, but don't do that. I said, honey, I am not going to do that for a really good reason. My parents' families were enormous. My mom was one of 10. My dad was one of 8. I had 17 aunts on both sides. All of them were formidable, talented, intelligent women, and not a single one of them ever realized the potential, because back then the ceiling wasn't glass, it was concrete. In this novel, I was trying to battle two things, two isms, racism and sexism. But again, I'll use the word confluence. That confluence was perfect for what I wanted to accomplish with this novel. Because you're absolutely right. Alone, Desiree and Jack could never have won this case. Coming together, they had a shot to do it. In this whole book, one of the themes that I wanted to drill home is this act of coming together, of uniting to achieve some worthy goal, not trying to go separately. Mockingbird, we had Atticus Finch. He was representing, you know, Tom Robinson against a totally, you know, racist jury system and court system. We knew he was going to lose really from the get-go, no matter what he said and what he did during the trial. I wanted to have, you know, a woman of color to come in who was the best attorney in the entire novel. You know, I wanted that to be clear. She was far better a lawyer than Jack ever would be, and she was far better than the counsel opposing her, because that was important for me. To be a black female attorney back then, you had to be 10 times better than any white male. to get to the same level. So that was very important. So I did, it was a very conscious decision on my part, how I structured how they were going to come together to battle this in a united way, with my hope being that people understand that united we are far stronger and far able to be successful than we are isolated. And as much as I love Mockingbird, for me, it didn't accomplish that goal. Because, you know, the black defendant in that case was only there to be saved by a white man. And I just wanted to go a little bit deeper than that.
And yet you have characters throughout the book to whom the innocence of Jerome Washington doesn't matter.
Right. It's almost as if it doesn't matter that if he didn't do it, he might have done it. He might have wanted to do it. He's a black person. It's not really important enough to worry about or concern yourself about whether he's guilty or innocent. If he goes to prison, he goes to the death, he goes to the electric chair. What does it really matter? You know, there's no value in thinking about that. And people say, oh my God, that's very harsh and draconian. And people don't think like that. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. People do think like that. And I grew up with a lot of, I grew up in a system that glorified that, actually. You know, you wouldn't think about it because it wasn't important.
Is Howard Pickett. He's one of your characters. And in fact, I call him the string puller because of the way he's always around. And he gets a gesture toward the end of the novel. It's kind of a moment of chaos and confusion. And he seems happy with the chaos and confusion.
Yeah, because chaos and confusion really works right to their playbook because people are afraid. They will look to the systems intact and in power to protect them, particularly if they're white people. Because they know that the white system will continue to protect them. So autocracy always needs a boogeyman. They need somebody to point at to be afraid of. And in this country, for centuries, it's been people of African-American descent to be afraid of. And, you know, I grew up learning that. I grew up, you know, being told that. I grew up with examples from lots of people I grew up with, you know, that was sort of the gospel. So the boogeyman argument has worked. And so when there's chaos and people feel afraid, they will turn to that power structure to protect them. And that's why oftentimes you will see the power structure itself deliberately incite the chaos and the fear, because that will just empower and embolden them even more.
Well, and you also have the Virginia Commonwealth attorney coming in to prosecute this case. And it's not entirely clear to me what role Pickett might have in orchestrating that. But George Wallace is, of course, in 1968 running for the presidency, hoping that the two major party candidates will split the vote and he'll end up siphoning off enough. And I don't think he came close, but he won a very large minority vote.
He won 5 states and 10 million votes in 1968, when I think the total number of votes might have been 50 million. That's significant.
It is significant. What does it mean that someone like that, a segregationist, I mean, you make mention of democracy and autocracy and a kind of division there in your author's note at the beginning. And I've heard, I know you've also talked about this somewhat in talking about this book. Most countries, as you have observed, are not democracies, most countries in the world. And does that mean that, you know, that we're living on borrowed time as a democracy?
Yeah, I think we're living on borrowed time if citizens don't step up to the responsibility they have as citizens in a democracy. We're not asked to do a lot in this country as a citizen as far as the political system goes. You know, you might donate a few bucks here and there. You can't donate $250 million like an Elon Musk. You're asked to, you know, every 2 years to go and spend a little bit of time on a day voting, or every 4 years for a president. Not a whole lot to ask, but more than half of us don't feel that that's important enough for us to go out and do that. So if you don't support, it's almost like supporting independent bookstores. If you don't support them, you go away. If you don't support something you really like, then it's going to go away. If you grow complacent about it, it's not going to be there the next day. When you go back and you wonder, where did my democracy go? Well, you know, you didn't vote in the last 10 elections, and you let people who are very extreme vote, and then all of a sudden, the country you thought you had is gone. Sorry, you know. So I don't think that people, you know, people are far more influenced by social media now than going out and reading, you know, actual newspapers or the real news. Disinformation is rampant. AI is only going to add to that. We are in true jeopardy of losing everything in this country.
Huge vulnerability. Yeah.
We are on the cusp of, I may be talking about the past, where people can create reality and sell it to lots of people who will believe it. I mean, really believe it. And then I don't know where you go from there. Then we all pull out our copy of 1984 and we go, well, you know, that George Orwell man, he was spot on.
I don't know if you've seen it, but the New York Times online, which is what I read every day, along with the Post online and a bunch of other things, but it had a kind of a quiz yesterday where, and it's probably up for several days, but you could go in and it would show you a little film clip, and you could decide whether you thought it was AI generated or real. And I'm happy to say I got 8 out of 10 correct, but it is, you have to really look for clues.
I think your average is far above what most people would have. And the other thing, it's not just, you know, being able to tell if something's AI generated. It's just foundational knowledge that is absent. I would say if you asked, 100 people in this country, define habeas corpus, probably 90% of them would not be able to truly define what it is or what due process actually means to them. And so if you don't know the rights you have, then when those rights are taken away, you don't notice, which for, authoritarian is awesome. That's like right. The whole grail.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, ignorance really is a major tool for an authoritarian. You were asked, I think you were in sixth grade, and you got on the bus and rode to what had been a predominantly or totally, I guess, black school.
Yes.
That was your system's answer to the integration issue. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, it was Central Gardens Elementary School, sixth grade. It was 1972. That summer, there was this huge protest. It was called SOS, or SONS, Save Our Neighborhood Schools. And I remember my parents took my brother and sister and I, because I was going to be the first kid to be bused to Central Gardens, which was an all-black school near inner city Richmond. And we drove to the Capitol with about thousands of other cars, and you drove around the Capitol honking your horn as a symbol of, save our neighborhood schools. Obviously, it didn't work. But, keep in mind, too, that Brown came down in 1954. Supreme Court said that the schools needed to be integrated with all deliberate speed. Well, a lot of states didn't focus on the word speed. They focused on the word deliberate. So what they did was either they gave public funds to private schools to start private all-white schools, which a lot of them did across the South, or else they closed the public schools. Nobody got an education. So 1972, obviously, was nearly 20 years after Brown v. Board. That's speed at a glacial pace. But off I went. And I spent a year at Central Gardens, and every class after me, my cousin was a year younger. He went the next year. It was a horrible experience. None of the kids, knew what was going on, black or white. All they knew is that half their friends were gone. They'd gone to another school, and all these kids, they had no idea who they were, came in from different backgrounds. And the other thing is, we were far better students because the resources we had in our white school were light years away from what they had. They had kids there who had been held back 3, 4, 5 years. In sixth grade, I was 12 years old. I was in class with guys who were 16 because they had just failed every year. The school had nothing in the way of resources. We would look around and the place was falling apart. You'd have like a few books for the entire class. So I would go in and I would ace every test because they were testing for things that I was doing in third grade. It was horrible. And there were fights that broke out. I got in fights pretty much every day. There was just anger and hostility. It was almost like, the adults said, we can't figure this out. So we're going to let the 12-year-olds do it, right? With no preparation, nothing. It just, we all showed up on the same day and everybody's looking around going, what is this? Maybe they thought that we would just all hug and kumbaya and everything would be perfect. And that's not what happened. Because I'm sure on my side, we were always taught that, we shouldn't associate with people. I'm sure on their side, they were taught, we're the enemy. We're the people that put, our families in jail.
You're the oppressors.
Yeah, we are. So it was horrible. It's terrible. My cousin came up the next year. He got in fights every day, just like I did. And it was terrible. And it was whatever goal they were reaching for, if it was a positive goal, they achieved the exact opposite of that. A lot of people that maybe had thought, maybe there's a shot, the race is being integrated, probably came away from that experience going, oh my God, I'll never forget this. It was horrible.
And I wonder if the segregationists didn't have a kind of ironic manipulativeness in mind when they did that.
They wanted to make the experience as bad as possible. That was clear. As a 12-year-old, I didn't understand that. I was just living my life day to day, trying to get through the school year. But looking back on it, right, another page from the playbook. And for some people, well, more than some, probably worked.
progress on with your education? I mean, so you survived, you moved on through other schools. I mean, what happened when you got to the high school level?
So in high school, I went to Henrico High School. That was integrated when I was there to the extent that now I could have black friends. Why did I have black friends? Because I was on the same sports teams they were. I played football and I was wrestled. So it was okay for me to have black friends because they were my teammates, you know, and that was acceptable. And we would go to tournaments together during the summer. I would drive and pick them up, and we'd go to different states and do wrestling tournaments, football practice, you know, during the summer, the two-a-days, everybody, you know, united because we were, you know, we were a part of a team, and that was important. And I've always thought that because of that, team sports is really important, not because you're going to turn pro one day. Most of us never are. This is because you build friendships and camaraderie and you unite together to achieve common goals. And those are all really good things for kids to learn early on.
Plus you're united in trying to survive two-a-days in 90 degree heat.
Yeah, I don't care where you're from or anything else, man. That's hard for everybody. So we could unite around the fact that we were miserable.
Exactly.
Because those were the days when the coaches were like, now they hydrate you to death, right? But those were the days like, you need a drink of water? Toughen up, young man. Toughen up. It's only 100 degrees out here. That was a turnaround experience for me. And maybe even my family, too, because, again, a lot of the young men that I played sports with, both football and wrestling, were black, and they were great athletes. You know, the old stereotype. They were just, you know, all the guys that I played with were far better athletes than I ever be in my whole life. I learned a lot from them, not just about the sports, but just about them. When I would go and pick them up in their neighborhoods, and people would all look at me because I'm a white guy driving through, you know, a totally black neighborhood, because redlining was totally in effect in Richmond. No black person could buy in a white neighborhood. And I was sort of the freak show coming through, and people would look at me and go, why is he here? It was just as screwed up as it possibly could be, you know, all around, that would be a problem. And of course, if a black person would ever have appeared on my street, you know, half the people there would have called the police. And that's just the way it was. But
and as you have observed, they would even now, if you had that black person, they would call in certain neighborhoods.
Absolutely. You know, I included in the Calamity of Souls that, you know, they mentioned a guy who had been walking through a white neighborhood and somebody called the police and they came and they shot him. Because why would you do that? Well, of course, he was up to something no good. He was looking for, you know, a house to break into, a car to steal, a child to kidnap. Why else would he have been there? Right. And I did that because those stories are happening today. And people could not look at that example in 1968 and realize, oh, wow, I just read about that in the newspapers the other day. You know, that it happened, you know, in Georgia or Alabama or wherever.
Well, and in fact, when you picked up the book, you drafted the first 150 pages or so. And when you picked it back up around 2020, George Floyd, I mean, yes, we have COVID, but we also had things that were also going on that are very relevant to the things of what you were writing about.
Yeah, George Floyd was, I really thought it felt like I was back in the 60s in the most vivid sort of way, and terrible sort of way. And, you know, the knee on the neck was symbolic, beyond symbolic. And that, for me, and then at the same time, you know, the political atmosphere, we all saw that something was coming that was not going to be terrific. And I just felt like the country was slipping away again. I thought that, you know, writing a novel set in 68, I really wanted to show that a novel that takes place 50 years ago. People think, and I hear that all the time, we've made so much progress. We're getting to where we're totally equal and egalitarian. Everything's great. We don't need affirmative action anymore. So I wanted to show a novel where things happening, you know, 50 years ago, you could read about them in the newspaper today. And so your argument of there's been so much progress made is not nearly as much as you think it has been. And you need to rethink your own personal decisions and choices in life and about where you think the country is going. Because in 50 years, you think we should have made a whole lot more progress than actually we've made so far. And that was important. That's why I didn't set the novel in present day. I wanted to show that the absence of progress over those five decades was far more, I thought, informative than going around saying, oh, the problem's solved. I mean, when Obama was elected, I heard so many people say, well, we're not a racist country anymore. Clearly, we elected a guy to the top spot who's black. And it was almost people like, okay, well, that's done. Check that one off the box and let's move on. Yeah, we moved on, but we moved in reverse, unfortunately. And Calamity was a way for me to sort of expound upon that and give my take on that and allow people to see that we have a lot of work ahead of us.
And your book shows it, but you also dramatize it in a discussion that Desiree and Jack have, where she talks about a friend of hers who clerked for one of the Supreme Court justices, and she said Brown could have gone the other way, except that the CJ, the Chief Justice, died of a heart attack, and Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren.
It would have been, I think, one of the justices took an informal poll while the Chief Justice was still the Chief Justice and had not died of the heart attack. And this case was brought to overturn Plessy v. Ferguson from 1896, which said separate but equal is constitutional. And the justice found that the Supreme Court would have upheld 5-4 Plessy v. Ferguson in 1954. So there would have been no order by the Supreme Court to integrate the school system. And the fact that he died of a heart attack that summer, and Eisenhower appointed, nominated, and the Senate confirmed Earl Warren, who had been governor of California, Republican, conservative. Eisenhower thought it was a safe choice. Later went on to say that Earl Warren was the biggest damn mistake he'd ever made in his entire administration. Earl Warren turned out to be not nearly as conservative as people thought. And because he was a politician, not really steeped in the law, he was able to cajole and push and encourage that court come out with an opinion, majority opinion, or a unanimous opinion, that separate but equal was inherently unequal.
Well, I was going to say, while that was a close decision, there were subsequent decisions, or looked like it was going to be a close decision with Douglas's little tallying. There were subsequent decisions where litigants came back, as they do with Supreme Court cases, and they try to, you know, take the case and, you know, edge in and take it apart, or, you know, get it reconsidered. But in subsequent decisions, it was upheld. And not only, you know, the issue of separate but equal is, you know, is not going to work because they're unequal inherently, but also the forced busing decision that reinforced it.
Yeah. I mean, I was impressed by the court holding firm across all lines, because these are deeply unpopular decisions, particularly not just in the South, but in many white communities. So they showed enormous courage, and they did the right thing. You know, I've been following how schools are doing over the, you know, last 20 schools probably now are as segregated as they were in the 1950s, unfortunately. And that's because we never solved the foundational problem of, you know, socioeconomic equality. So, you know, the wealthier neighborhoods are white, and those kids go to those schools, and the black communities are poor for reasons they have no control over at all. And now schools are segregated again, which is a terrible thing, because you know, separating people is never good. Because when you separate people, they always try to think of a reason why, and usually sometimes they will think it's a bad reason. Well, it's a good reason that we're separated, because they're just different people. And here we go again, the whole thing, round and round the circle we go. So we have the boogeyman scapegoat once again, rearing its ugly head.
And I just want to underscore, you say this as someone who was put on a bus and sent in a very confusing environment, and as you said, got into fights almost every day as a result of that confusion and environment that you were tossed into.
What saved me were books. You know, I would read when I was a voracious reader from a young age. I was a political science major at VCU. I read books by all sorts of different writers. Here's the thing about books. Your personal experience as a human cannot possibly encapsulate all opportunities of human experience. Nobody lives life like that. You have to fill out the rest of it through reading. So through books, you will meet more people than you ever will in real life. And you will go to places and books that you will never travel to in real life. And you will go to places and books that you can't travel to in real life, like the past and the future, which often gives you important perspectives. So for me, I would read about people who had been oppressed, having nothing to do with themselves and what they did, just because of the power structures. And for me, books grant you the greatest human attribute there is. Why is it the greatest? Because it leads to all the other best in humanity, and that's empathy. If you don't have empathy, you're not going to make good decisions, not only for yourself, but for other people. Empathy leads to kindness and to love and to dignity and respect. The absence of empathy in your life leads to the exact opposite of all those things. It leads to cruelty and mean-spiritedness and wanting to dominate other people and wanting to divide people because you think yourself superior. That's what the lack of empathy does. So books saved me. They allowed me to understand why, one part of the country had every reason to be incredibly angry and frustrated and just maddened by what had been done to them. If I had just listened to people that I grew up with and had not read books that explained it in great depth, I could have turned out very differently. But once you start reading, it's very crystal clear, because you just have to ask yourself one question. If that had been me, what would I do? What would I have done? Would I be angry and mad and full of hatred? Absolutely, I would be. Nobody likes to be treated unfairly. Would I be ticked off if my ancestors had been enslaved and I'm enslaved just in a different way? Of course I would. So reading is where you needed to go, because you're not going to hear that from other people for the most part. Nobody's going to go and listen to people on a street corner. You have to go and read about it. And that's what I did. And that books transformed my entire life. And that made me who I am today. I'm only a writer today because I was a reader as a kid. Books filled me with a spirit that I wanted to take words and to turn them into tools to make the world better, to make the world entertained, to make the world more informed, to make the world think about things that I think are important to think about.
When I think about your books, one of the things that strikes me very strongly is that you are not bashful about having events happen in your books. And this is not just a political aspect of your work, but it's philosophical, but it's also just from a craft standpoint. And that's something that I'd like to hear you talk about just for a moment. I mean, we talked earlier about the confluence of your writerly experience and your own growth intellectually and emotionally to be able to do this particular novel. But I think, looking at the growth of your novel, the growth of craft, but even at the beginning with Absolute Power, you were not bashful about having events happen.
Events are punches in the face, and events are a way for a writer to get readers out of the comfort zone. I don't want a reader to read my books and feel comfortable all the way through, because they're not going to get the reaction that I want them to get. I want them to have a visceral response to what I'm talking about in the novel and the things that happen. The way to do that is to make dramatic, extraordinary things, sometimes violent, painful things happen to human beings in the novel. Because human beings, my characters, are the only way I can connect on a human level with a reader. The plots aren't going to do that for me. The plots are just there sort of as the mechanism that I can walk my characters through. But if someone is hurt or died, or they lose someone they love, or they do something terrible themselves to other people, that's going to get that visceral reaction that I want from readers, because they're going to remember that after they close the last page. That's going to carry on with them and what they do. And they may come back to that at some point in their lives and think about that. What would I have done? How would I have reacted to that? Events are punches in the face to get you out of complacency. And I do it in all of my books. One, because I want the reader's attention to be riveted, but also because I want the reader to think later about what I'm writing about.
The other thing that I've seen in your novels is what I would call redemptive possibilities for your characters. Now, that's not to say you don't slay the innocents sometimes. That happens. But you do have characters, be they good or bad, who have these redemptive possibilities. In this particular novel, Jack is one such character.
I'm a huge believer in the possibility of redemption. I'm one of the few Italian Americans. I was raised Baptist, not Catholic, in Richmond. My dad's family had left the church before they came over from Italy. And so in Baptist teachings, you hear a lot about, a lot of fire and brimstone, but also the possibility of redemption. You can turn your life around. You can be healed. And you can turn into a better person. You just have to work at it. You have to make good decisions. I like to think that no one is beyond redemption. I'm not sure that I'm entirely correct about that, but that's my hope anyway. And in my novels, I try to set people up in some ways that allow them to seek that opportunity. And if they, and as a writer, obviously, I'm not talking about the characters do it all themselves. Obviously, I tell the characters what to do. But in my mind, when I create a character, I sort of create this template. And then as I'm writing the novel, that template is fleshed out into something more significant and lasting. It's not just an outline or anything anymore. It's a living, breathing person who just happens to appear on a piece of paper. And then I try to build them in a way that it has to get to the point where I or they have to decide which way they're going to go. Are they going to actually seize the opportunity and try to make sense of what they did and try to make amends? Or are they going to just continue on down the path that I gave them from the initial, the beginning of the novel? And those are tough decisions for me. I mean, in Calamity, I had decided early on that the two police officers were not going to be capable of redemption. Made one for sure was not going to be capable of redemption. The other one, you weren't really sure. Maybe until the end, maybe after that, maybe he would rethink because of what happened in his life. But the other characters in the novels, they could have gone either way. And both on the white side of the ledger and on the black side of the ledger too, because there was a de redemption possibilities everywhere for everyone. It's a tough one, but I'm still a firm believer in it. And once I stop believing that, I don't know. It's going down a rabbit hole I don't think I want to go down.
That kind of applies to your world vision, doesn't it?
It does. It's totally my world vision. I think that people who make poor decisions, at least how I define poor decisions, and maybe how most people would define them, it's not because they're inherently bad. There are very few Ted Bundys who are just born missing a vital chromosome that doesn't allow empathy to appear in their consciousness. Most people, if they do bad things, it's because of the environment in which they were raised. And so many people that go on to hurt people were abused and hurt themselves growing up. It's not an excuse, but it's also a fact that we have to take into account. So my worldview is that people can change if you treat them with kindness and respect and dignity, if you educate them, if you let them learn things that nobody else had ever taught them, if you allow them to become empathetic. Everybody, for the most part, again, unless you're missing, a vital piece of your brain, has the ability to do that. It's just getting them down that right road and letting them follow it along. I think it can be a beautiful thing when someone who has done terrible things has an epiphany. We talked about George Wallace. After he was nearly assassinated and paralyzed before he died, he recanted all of the vitriol that he had spewed his entire life and said he was sorry, apologized, and said he was wrong about that. Some people will say, well, that's, a day late and a dollar short, but at least he made, the statement. He attempted to sort of redeem himself in the eyes of others. And, as much as I disagreed with everything he stood for his entire life, I respected him for doing that because he didn't have to do it.
In the end, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I'm an optimist because so many days I want to be a pessimist.
Or you feel pessimistic?
I feel pessimistic, and I fight against that because I think if we all believe there's no way back, that we're guaranteeing that there's no way back. So I prefer to think that positive things are on the horizon. We all just need to pull together. We need to think about where we came from, where we are now, and what are the possibilities of where we might be going.
I think that's a great note on which to end, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
No, I enjoyed it very much when I heard about your Richmond connection. I delivered the Times Dispatch for 8 years. Get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's 24 every day of the year, including Christmas. And the series of stories that you worked on. I was a teenager during the 70s, and when I saw that, when the request came in, and I saw that connection, I was like, I got to talk to him because we had that in common.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your feedback helps others find the show. Be sure to follow us on social media and check out our website at upstartcrow.org for more information on our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of the links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.